Well met, and welcome to episode 62, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 16th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we continue our month-long discussion of the second part of Henry IV with the conclusion of our plot synopsis. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. When we left off at the end of Act 3 last week, Henry was facing a rebellion led by the Archbishop of York and the Lords of Mowbray and Hastings. However, two of the holdover rebels from the first part, Northumberland and Glendower, are nowhere to be seen. Northumberland has been convinced by his wife and daughter-in-law to seek refuge in Scotland, while there are rumors, true in this case, that Glendower is dead. Meanwhile, Falstaff is back to his old tricks, Hal is estranged again from his father, and that father, King Henry IV, is ailing. Act 4 begins in the rebel camp at Galtree Forest. Our usual suspects of Hastings, the Archbishop, and Mowbray are there. Northumberland is, of course, not. He is retired to Scotland. Instead, the rebels find themselves facing upward of 30,000 troops. From their enemy, the royals, Westmoreland comes as an emissary to accuse them of base and bloody insurrection. The archbishop, in turn, accuses the nation of surfeiting in wanton hours, which disease our late King Richard, being infected, died. Westmoreland reaches out to Mowbray, reminding him that he has had his father's titles and lands restored to him. But it is obvious that Mowbray still harbors resentment, denouncing what has miscarried under Bolingbroke. Westmoreland has a mission, though. Here come I from our princely general to know your griefs, to tell you from his grace that he will give you audience, and wherein it shall appear that your demands are just, you shall enjoy them, everything set off that might so much as think you enemies. It seems that the king is making the same offer as he had in the first part, redress of wrongs. Only this isn't the king, but the princely general. Now, before we can think that it is Hal, the heir apparent, who is giving the orders, however, we are reminded that it is Prince John who Westmoreland is accompanying. The archbishop gives over a list of their grievances, and they await their fate. The second scene brings King John into the discussion. The archbishop tells him of what he has given Westmoreland, the parcel and particulars of their grief. So there's a list of issues, but he doesn't state them. The prince reads them and likes them all and does allow them well. And so the prince doesn't explain them either. The prince's allowance is enough for the rebels, who capitulate and send out messengers to deliver news of peace. But once this is announced, Westmoreland drops the bombshell on Hastings. I do arrest thee, traitor, of high treason, and you, Lord Archbishop, and you, Lord Mowbray, of capital treason I attach you both. When the archbishop asks if they've been betrayed, the prince explains himself. I promised you redress of these same grievances whereof you did complain, which, by mine honor, I will perform with a most Christian care. But for you, rebels, look to taste the due meat for rebellion and such acts as yours. Now, is this betrayal? Is this what King Henry would have done? After all, remember, it was Hal's decision to release the Scot Douglas at the end of the first part. Is this what Hal would have done? And more importantly, is any of this kingly? Act 4, Scene 3 takes us to another part of the battlefield where Falstaff takes a prisoner. And we see the chaos of war, the winds of change, as Prince John and Westmoreland arrive. Prince John says, Now, have you left pursuit? Westmoreland responds, Retreat is made, and execution stayed. John of Lancaster then says, Send Colville with his confederates to York to present execution. Now, the retreat has been sounded, and that makes sense as the war is ending. Hastings, the archbishop, and Mowbray have been arrested. Their execution, I suppose, could have been stayed. Yet Prince John reverses this reversal by sending Falstaff's prisoner Colville to his death. Prince John also announces that he must go to London, where his father is sore sick, and he tells Falstaff, like Hal did a play ago, that he will better speak of him than he deserves. John leaves Falstaff alone, and the old man tells us, If I had 1,000 sons, the first humane principle I would teach them should be to forswear thin potations and addict themselves to sack. And he almost succeeded with Prince Hal. The fourth and fifth and final scene of Act IV takes us back to the palace and the dying king. Henry speaks with grief over Hal's unguided days and rotten times, only to be reassured by Warwick that the prince will, in the perfectness of time, cast off his followers, and their memory shall, as a pattern or a measure, live, by which his grace must meet the lives of others, turning past evils to advantages. Buoyed by this, as well as news that Northumberland has been captured, Henry knows that he should rejoice now. But he collapses instead, and his sons and nobles take him to his chamber, where he calls for music, hearkening back, if you remember, to Richard II's final hours. With his crown by his pillow, he begins to doze as Hal appears, and the brothers leave Hal with his father. Hal then notices, by his gates of breath there lies a downy feather, which stirs not. Did he suspire that light and weightless down perforce must move? My gracious lord, my father. Thinking his father is dead, his guilt breaks, and he tells the dead king, thy due from me is tears and heavy sorrows of the blood, which nature, love, and filial tenderness shall, O dear father, pay thee plenteously. My due from thee is this imperial crown, which as immediate as thy place and blood derives itself to me. He puts on the crown and in grief leaves the room. Only there's one problem. The king wakes up and finds the crown gone and jumps to the conclusion that Hal did so hunger for his chair that Hal would take the crown for himself. Hal returns and Henry begins to chide Hal in much the same way as he did in the first part. Hal apologizes for the misinterpretation. The king accepts the apology and then admits to Hal the bypaths and indirect crooked ways by which he took the crown, saying that made the crown troublesome as it sat upon his head. The father hopes that it will descend with better quiet, better opinion, better confirmation upon the son's head. Henry then advises Hal to busy giddy minds with foreign quarrels so that men may forget what Henry had done. And then Hal and his brothers take Henry to the Jerusalem chamber of the palace, where Henry can die. It's as close to the Holy Land as Henry will ever get. And thus ends Act IV, and what's there left to do? The fifth and final act begins back at the home of Justice Shallow, he of the Oxford-attending Cousin William, and of the shared history with Falstaff. Falstaff has returned for a visit, and is now stating his desire to end the visit. You must excuse me. Shallow refuses, however, instead giving orders to his servant Davy to prepare a large dinner. Of course, it's possible that Falstaff is only playing up his desire to leave so that he will be invited to dinner, especially since once he's left alone, he reveals to us that he intends to listen to his superior in social rank and class. I will devise matter enough of this Shallow to keep Prince Harry in continual laughter. Falstaff can foresee a time when he'll need new stories to tell Hal, and he's not above stealing Shallows for the purpose. Act 5, Scene 2 takes us to the royal court, where the Chief Justice and we learn that Henry IV lives no more. When the Chief Justice mentions that he wishes he had died with the king, Warwick understands, indeed, I think the young king loves you not. This again ties into the legend discussed by Falstaff earlier in the play, that a young and impetuous Hal struck the Chief Justice. We understand the fear that Hal is still young and impetuous. Warwick sees the other sons of Henry IV and wishes Hal had the temper of the worst of these three gentlemen, and he fears having to salute or strike sail to the spirits of the same vile sort as Falstaff. And it's not just the nobles who fear this. The brothers do too, as Clarence states, well, you must now speak fair of Sir John Falstaff. When Henry V enters, he understands the discomfort of the nobles, and he tries to reassure his brothers that he will act kingly. I'll be your father and brother, too. When he sees the Chief Justice, he meets the subject unblinkingly. You are, I think, assured I love you not. The Chief Justice admits so much, explaining that he took on the action that spurred Hal's striking of him because he saw Hal as an offender to his father. Furthermore, he assures the new king, behold yourself so by a son disdained, and then imagine me taking your part, and in your power soft silencing your son. It's a non-apologetic but completely respectful reply, and Henry sees that the justice is right, so much so that he asks the Chief Justice to keep those titles and duties under King Henry V. The new king understands that he will now have to mock the expectation of the world, to frustrate prophecies, and to raise out rotten opinion, who hath writ me down after my seeming. He understands how the world sees him, and he knows he must change. From that realization, we move in Act 5, Scene 3, to Shallow's estate again, where Shallow and Falstaff have finished dinner, but the drinking has continued. The short scene is filled with drinking songs, interrupted only by the entrance of Pistol, who carries with him news that Henry V's the man. Falstaff's lambkin is now king, and Falstaff promises Shallow, whatever office he wilt in the land, 'tis his. And it's not enough that Falstaff will be able to give these titles as presents to his friends. He cannot wait to bring woe to the Chief Justice. In the quick Act 5, Scene 4, we find the Beadle arresting Mistress Quickly and Doll Tearsheet, and the two women cannot wait for Falstaff to arrive so that the Beadle may be swinged or beaten. It seems the ladies are counting Falstaff's chickens before they're hatched as well. In the final scene of the play, the coronation train of King Henry V passes by, followed by Falstaff and his entourage. Falstaff is joyous, anticipating great times ahead. But when he calls out, God save thy grace, King Hal, my royal Hal, he does not get the response he expects. I know thee not, old man. Falter thy prayers. How ill white hairs become a fool and jester. I have long dreamed of such a kind of man, so surfeit-swelled, so old, and so profane. But being awaked, I do despise my dream. Make less thy body hence, and more thy grace. Leave gormandizing. Know the grave doth gape for thee thrice wider than for other men. Reply not to me with a fool-born jest. Presume not that I am the king I was. For God doth know, so shall the world perceive that I have turned away my former self, and so will I those that kept me company. When thou dost hear that I am as I have been, approach me, and thou shalt be as thou wast, the tutor and feeder of my riots. Till then, I banish thee on pain of death, as I have done the rest of my misleaders, not to come near our person by 10 mile. And if that wasn't bad enough, he orders the Chief Justice to see perform the tenor of our word. And the king leaves Falstaff without another statement. Falstaff is sure that he shall be sent for in private to the king. But that is not to be, as the Chief Justice re-enters and proclaims, go carry Sir John Falstaff to the fleet. Take his company along with him. And as Falstaff's entourage is taken off to prison, Henry's brother John is then left to say, I like this fair proceeding of the king's. He shall intent his wanted followers shall all be very well provided for, but all are banished until their conversations appear more wise and modest to the world. Thus, there is hope for Falstaff, and a hint to the actions of the next play, bearing out our civil swords as native fires as far as France. And this play is over, save for a 31-line epilogue, apologizing for lately here in the end a displeasing play, promising a continuance of the story with Sir John in it and fair Catherine of France, and reminding the audience that Falstaff is not Oldcastle. And on that very bizarre note, the play ends. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with the daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Dorothy and Ursula, Names of Dames, Sequelitis, and Sources. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 16th, 2011. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.